Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Sumi Somaskander from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the US election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, I'm Charles Gitonga, and here is what's coming up for you on this edition of Focus on Africa. South African authorities are reporting that over 300 cargo containers have fallen off ships sailing around the Cape of Good Hope in recent months. We'll hear the reasons why. And a continental football tournament qualifier between Libya and Nigeria hangs in the balance, but this has nothing to do with the field of play.
Apparently the Nigerian team was in the air even before the Libyan team, who was supposed to host them. And again, the Nigerian delegation justifies this by saying there are very stringent search policies when you leave the country. Even the Nigerian team is subject to them. However, because they're so familiar with standard operating procedures, they send the equipment managers to the airport hours ahead of time, even before their own team gets to the airport, so they can go through these security measures. And the Libyan team didn't do that.
It's Tuesday, October 15th. First, we go to Mbani, Kokotia, and Konga. Well, in case you're wondering where that is, you have every right to, because these are three small and little-known islands off the coast of West Africa. But they are the center of a dispute between Equatorial Guinea and Gabon that's reached the International Court of Justice, ICJ. The two countries border each other, and the islands lie just off the coast of Gabon, but also close to Guinea. So why are these countries so interested in a group of small islands? The answer is resources. Mbani, Kokotia and Konga are said to be in a part of the ocean that's rich in hydrocarbons, or simply put, oil and gas. Before we get into some analysis of this, there is a bit of history you need to know. So here is my colleague Nyasha Michelle with a timeline, and you may not be surprised to know that the issue starts with colonization.
During the colonial period, Spain ruled what would become Equatorial Guinea, and France ruled what would become Gabon. Equatorial Guinea bases its claim to the islands on a treaty that was signed between these two colonial powers in the year 1900. It's called the Treaty of Paris. Then, in 1972, Gabon's army pushed Equatorial Guinea out of the island of Mbanié and established a military presence there. Gabon says that in 1974, a new treaty was signed which confirmed its sovereignty over the islands. That's called the Bata Convention. But here's where it gets a bit complicated. Equatorial Guinea says it never signed this and that Gabon only produced a copy of the treaty by surprise in a meeting in 2003. In the early 2000s, oil was discovered in the area, and that's when the dispute over the islands started to heat up again. In 2016, the country signed a new agreement saying they would allow the International Court of Justice to settle the dispute. And yes, both agree they've signed that one.
Thanks to my colleague, Nyasha Michelle. So last week, the ICJ finished hearing the submissions from the two countries and is expected to make a decision next year. Someone who knows all about this dispute is Hassan Tukur, who used to be Nigeria's ambassador to Equatorial Guinea and has mediated in a number of other maritime border disputes.
These islands, they are not much habited, but the issue there is about the hydrocarbons in the area. So these islands are there. They are part of colonial Equatorial Guinea, which Equatorial Guinea inherited from the Spanish colonial masters. So when this kind of dispute comes in, right, you either get a title of land, either through a title or through treaties. If you recall, at the inception of the Organization of African Union, part of the treaty was that colonial boundaries has to be respected. So this is Equatorial Guinea's position on this issue. Then Gabon, the crisis started in 1972, and 1974 they sat down to negotiate an agreement, and they are saying there is a document that gives them that title to that area.
How did this dispute between Equatorial Guinea and Gabon come about?
I think the dispute started in 1972 when both countries are claiming to the areas. In the 70s, when Gabon sent in military to that area, Equatorial Guinea was in no position to challenge that. But the importance of the area now, I think, is pushing Equatorial Guinea to claim its sovereignty over the islands. What brought it now to prominence is the discovery of hydrocarbon in the area. Everybody is looking for hydrocarbon. And then Gabon has hydrocarbon. Equatorial Guinea came into the hydrocarbon regime in the 90s. So this now put pressure on the countries to claim additional maritime boundary areas. And if you look at Gabon and Equatorial Guinea, they are ordinarily brotherly countries who are next to one another, and they have ethnic affinities too, because you have the Fang in Equatorial Guinea, you have also Fang in Gabon. So ordinarily, they should not have conflict on this. When I was there, the relationship between late Umar Bongo and President Obiang, who is still there, was a very, very excellent relationship. Of recent, of course, there have been changes in Gabon. Relationship-wise, they have good relations, but, maritime boundary, you can have good relationship with a country, but you still have maritime boundary disputes.
In the process of this conversation over the years, there was a treaty that is being quoted even at the International Court of Justice, something called the Bata Convention, which Gabon says that it's a treaty signed in 1974 and it gave it sovereignty over the islands. But Equatorial Guinea says they never signed anything like that. Why is there so much confusion about this treaty?
Well, Equatorial Guinea is saying maybe the confusion is that it was negotiated, it was not signed. And you know, this is how the process of negotiation is. I have a little bit of experience with some of the West African countries that we negotiated. When you negotiate a treaty, it has to be signed, it has to be ratified by your parliament, and then you have to deposit it at the United Nations. Nigeria did that because we have experience of doing maritime boundary negotiation with almost all our countries. Perhaps Nigeria is the only country that now we have concluded our maritime boundary negotiations. Now, maybe by the time, I'm not sure, by the time they negotiated the treaty in the 70s, none of their parliaments have ratified this. And then they have not deposited with the United Nations so that you can quote it and you can make a reference to it. So these are the things that ought to have been done. Then you will have no way of exiting.
Right. So just help us understand, given your experience, how maritime boundaries work. And when there are disputes, how are they settled?
There are various ways of settling maritime boundary. You can do it bilaterally. You can take it to court as they have taken it to court. Or you can fight it out, which I don't encourage. So the most preferable thing to do on maritime boundary is a bilateral negotiation between the two countries, because it's a give and take. Both countries will realize that if they don't agree, they take it to court, they may lose. So it's better you negotiate a maritime boundary with your neighboring country. And in any event, it's a neighboring country. You cannot move your boundary. You can fight with somebody far away, but you can't continue fighting with your neighbor. So if you negotiate a maritime boundary settlement, you stand to get a better deal. Why? Because it is too expensive. For example, I can tell you, during our case with the Bakassi Peninsula with Cameroon, Nigeria spent over £300 million paying lawyers, technical people, advisors. It's not necessary. £300 million can do a lot of projects for any country, even including Nigeria. So it's better you negotiate it. And if you don't agree on maritime boundary, what is it are they arguing about? They're arguing about hydrocarbon and resources. Go for a joint development zone. Extract the resources. By the time you extract the resources, you agree on a sharing formula, the countries benefit, and then the source of conflict will not be there. And then you don't waste any time. If you go to the ICJ, they will pass a judgment. You will still have to come back on the negotiating table to conclude it. Well, they will not demarcate your boundary. And even if they give you the boundary, you will not have to implement it. So you can see it's time wasting, time consuming, and you hold up vital resources that both countries will need. And from our experience, not only Cameroon, we negotiated maritime boundary with Equatorial Guinea too. We have a definitive maritime boundary with Equatorial Guinea. We went further and unitized the oil fields between Nigeria and Equatorial Guinea. We disputed that. From that arrangement, Nigeria got about 62 million barrels of hydrocarbon crude oil. So you can do it peacefully without anybody taking money from you, either geologists, technical people, lawyers, who will always want you to go to court. We should discourage that in Africa. We can agree. I have seen how African countries are just messed up by these international advisors or lawyers. They would want you to go to court for obvious reasons, because they make money. So why should they make money while you are languishing in poverty?
Right. Thank you very much, Hassan, for your time.
All right, Charles. Thank you. Enjoy Nairobi.
All right. Bye. That's Hassan Tukur, Nigeria's former ambassador to Equatorial Guinea. The conflict in the Middle East impacts countries around the world in one form or another. Now, one example of how it's impacting the African continent is one you might already be familiar with. And if not, here's a reminder. It's a tension near the Horn of Africa, more specifically off the coast of Somalia, Djibouti and Eritrea, where Houthi rebels, a group backed by Iran, have launched more than 40 attacks on commercial ships in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. This has been taking place since November last year, making it a volatile region to pass through. The attacks are in response to the war in Gaza. So because of these attacks, cargo ships have been choosing a longer route around the southernmost tip of Africa, the Cape of Good Hope, which is dangerous for different reasons. In this case, natural elements making it an extremely challenging part for ships to navigate. The harsh conditions here have resulted in cargo ships losing several items overboard. It's part of a recent trend of cargo losses from container ships, and it's impacting South Africa's coastline. I've been speaking to Sobhantu Tilahi, the Chief Operating Officer for the South African Maritime Safety Authority, who explains the challenges they face, but also the role international maritime law plays in all of this.
It's a phenomenon that we have never experienced before. We have had about 7 ships that lost cargo overboard, and reportedly over 300 containers that have been lost. We knew that with the diversion of those ships from the Red Sea, we were going to pick up additional traffic, which we did. And we've got a Sea Watch Center that assists us to track the numbers. So we've seen definitely an increase. But as well, we've had very rough sea conditions over the winter period. We normally get those rough conditions, but we have a lot more freak waves during this past winter season. So it was a combination of 2 events, an increased traffic experiencing worse than normal weather conditions on our coastline.
But is the area around the Cape of Good Hope, is it a difficult area for ships to navigate normally?
Well, the Cape of Good Hope is known as the Cape of Storms. You've got a phenomenon with the southernmost part of the continent before Antarctica. So it's generally an open coast with very little shelter. So all the weather that you pick up from the poles, it picks up speed and the conditions deteriorate. So by the time you hit the Cape, those storms have been building energy over such a long period and long distances. So the Cape is known for those difficulties. Coupled with the fact that you've got the confluence of the Indian Ocean, which is some warmer ocean, and the Atlantic Ocean. So you do tend to pick up a lot of turbulence around particularly the Cape Point, and that is where the biggest storms get to hit.
So at the South African Maritime Safety Authority, how have you been interacting with the ships that are in distress?
We are part of the International Maritime Search and Rescue Organization. So we are obliged in terms of international law and in terms of our coastal responsibilities to assist those ships that are sailing on the coast. Now, we've got a Maritime Rescue Coordination Center, and it is a world approach that the ships, once they send out a distress signal, we would pick up that signal. And depending on what the distress is, we would obviously establish communication with the ship in trouble, if we can, or those ships that are close by. And then we would then coordinate either the rescue or whatever other assistance that ship in trouble requires. Ships, when they lose cargo, they've got a duty to report to us. And they have a duty because we've been losing more containers. In fact, we've almost exclusively lost all the cargo that was lost overboard is containerized cargo. Now, when a container falls into the water, there is a risk that it doesn't sink to the bottom immediately. So it is an underwater obstruction. So it becomes a navigational hazard. For that reason, when a container is reported to have been lost overboard, then we are obliged to send out a navigation notice to all the other ships that are sailing so that they can watch out, try and avoid the position, just in case that container has not sank to the bottom. So that is the protocol that we follow when cargo has been lost overboard. Once the ship reports to have lost the container, obviously issues of liability arise, so they also have to tell us who their insurers are, and that ship is responsible for the container, including the damage that container may have. So immediately then we would mobilize over and above issuing navigation warnings. We would mobilize aerial checks or whichever other checks that can be used if there are ships close by to do some spotting to see if we can locate the container and mark its position. Some of those containers have washed up ashore. We had a container that washed up cargo of biscuits, and by the time it hit shore, it had opened up, and we had to tell the insurers to go and then salvage the container as well as the cargo. We have seen cargo washing up, as I was saying, biscuits, we've seen car tires, we've seen pieces of furniture. We've seen also some cargoes that should not end up on the coast, like medical supplies, pills, etc. But we've got a protocol, and South African Maritime Safety Authority, we then link up with our local government authorities on the coast so that they provide the first response for us. So we've got a system that we've had to develop to respond. Once a container is spotted, then we invoke a protocol. We call it the Maritime Incident Management System.
How then are you preventing this cargo, especially the one that will wash up the shore, from getting into the wrong hands? Because you've described car tires, biscuits. Those are things that ordinary people might find use for.
The cargo belongs to the ship owner, and that's in terms of your international law. Anything that has been salvaged can be linked back to the ship owner. The local authorities, which take responsibility for their beaches and coastline, then work with us to try and protect those cargoes. I know in one instance, we worked with the local police where we had medical supplies that were picked up, because then we needed to find a way to secure those cargoes and then get the insurance to deal with the cleanup and picking up all the costs that we're incurring in dealing with those cargoes.
So, Mr. Tila, it does sound like a very busy time for South Africa and the Maritime Safety Authority that you work for. How is all this costing the country?
It's a big cost. Fortunately for us, all the casualties have had adequate insurance, so the cost of the response was taken care of. However, there is the cost that the authority must incur. Where we can allocate that cost to the incident, we do so. But there are costs that invariably, as a state, we must carry. So it has come at a cost to our economy. It could have been worse, thanks to the insurance that generally comes through. But issues of civil liability are very clear on international law. The shipping company or the ship owner must pay for the damage that's caused by their ship.
Thank you very much, sir, for your time, and we'll leave it there for today.
Thank you so much.
Sobantu Tilayi, Chief Operations Officer for the South African Maritime Safety Authority. This is Focus on Africa from the BBC World Service.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
The Nigerian men's national football team has returned home from Libya without playing a vital international match. That's after the players suffered what they called inhumane treatment. The Super Eagles had been due to land in Benghazi for today's Africa Cup of Nations qualifier against Libya, but their plane was diverted to an airfield 200 kilometers away from where they were supposed to land, where the players say they were held for more than 10 hours. Libya's Football Federation says this wasn't deliberate. The Confederation of African Football, CAF, said that the matter has been referred to its disciplinary board for investigation and action will be taken if rules have been violated. So was this due to lack of communication, lack of coordination, or was it because of vengeance? Our football guru, Meher Mezahi in Algeria, has been filling in the gaps.
It's a long story, and it's one that isn't exactly new on the African continent. But essentially what we're looking at is teams that are completely unafraid of any punitive measures from the regulating body, the Confederation of African Football, and that are trying to use what's supposed to be duties as hosts instead as privilege and trying to gain any kind of advantage possible. This all started, according to the Libyan national team, 5 or 6 days ago when they landed in Nigeria. They claimed that their airplane was diverted. Instead of landing in Uyo, they landed in Port Harcourt, and then that the conditions that were provided to them for transportation up to Uyo were not up to standard. And essentially, they were so incensed that they even, according to the Nigerian Football Federation, threatened, in quotes, that the Nigerians would face the same thing. And essentially, that's what we saw yesterday. Nigeria were supposed to fly directly to Benghazi to play the second match of these African Cup of Nations qualifiers of the month of October. And instead of landing in Benghazi, their airplane was diverted to Labrak. And there, the Nigerian players were kept for up to 15 hours, according to claims from the Nigerian delegation, without food, without water, without internet. And eventually, the Nigerian delegation just decided to go home instead of stick it out and play the match when the team bus finally arrived 15 hours later.
So let's talk about what happened to the Libya's national team then, just what you described. How did the match go and did it affect the play in any way?
Well, to be honest, the only person to really speak out about it at the time was their captain, Faisal Al-Badri, and he made a post on Facebook in Arabic, and it was quite a lengthy post with a few photos of players sleeping at the airport. Nobody else really spoke about it too much, and the match was played quite normally. It resulted in a 1-0 victory for Nigeria. They scored with just 4 minutes left to play, so it was quite a tight match. But then we didn't really hear much more about it until right before the Nigerian team's departure, because the Libyan delegation was even more incensed to learn that on their way out of the country, they were also delayed at the airport again. Apparently, the Nigerian team was in the air even before the Libyan team, who was supposed to host them. And again, the Nigerian delegation justifies this by saying there are very stringent search policies when you leave the country. Even the Nigerian team is subject to them. However, because they're so familiar with standard operating procedures, they send the equipment managers to the airport hours ahead of time, even before their own team gets to the airport, so they can go through these security measures. And the Libyan team didn't do that. And so there's quite clearly a lack of communication, a lack of coordination between the two teams that probably resulted in the stoking of suspicion. And essentially what we see, if we had to guess, if you ask the consensus of journalists, what would be the motive behind this? It seems to be some kind of vengeance or justice from the Libyan national team delegation. Just one final clarification, Charles. It should be mentioned that just a few days ago, the Libyan Football Federation president resigned from his post. And so it isn't exactly clear if their delegation is completely staffed, if there are new people in the position that aren't familiar with the travel procedures. All of that could be exacerbating the logistics of all of this.
But then you have the teams blaming each other. So you have the Nigerian team blaming the Libyans for the treatment, and you have the Libyans sort of blaming the Nigerians as well for the same. Is this anything to do with the play on the field, or are there forces behind these teams that would be causing such issues?
Yeah, I wouldn't say that it's anything that happened on the pitch during the 90 minutes. We could definitely say that there's a lot of pressure on both of these teams. Libya are not doing well in the African Cup of Nations or in the World Cup qualifiers. And we could say the same thing about Nigeria. Ever since their coach, Jose Pesero, that took them to the final of the African Cup of Nations earlier this year, back in January, his contract was not renewed in March. And ever since then, Nigeria has been sort of jumping from interim manager to interim manager. And they also haven't had great results. So there's been a lot of pressure on both of these historically rich footballing nations to get results. And sometimes that can push teams to sort of wade into these dark art techniques, so to speak. I think that could definitely be some of the reasons why. But essentially what we're looking at, we don't really know the nitty-gritty details of the communication between the two federations. Now CAF is going to open an investigation. That's what they announced yesterday. Once we start getting, you know, email correspondences and WhatsApp correspondences, that's when I think we can start to have a clear idea exactly of what happened and who was at fault for both of these trips, both to Uyo and to Benghazi.
So for the African Cup of Nations then, how are the logistics planned in terms of who's hosting what and what they need to have ready, including the final logistics of where they arrive at and how they go to their hotels, how they get to the field of play? How is that all that organized?
Yeah, you're asking a very, very important question. This really is the crux of the issue, because ideally, and this has happened in other competitions in African football. For example, last year in the African Football League, some kind of body was created that was in charge of logistics, a sort of middleman, you know, acts between federations where, for example, the visiting delegation would agree with travel plans with the home delegation prior to the match being played. And then a travel plan was established days in advance. And then nobody could really change the travel plan without subject to, unless there was, you know, a case of force majeure or something like that, but it had to be justified. So in this case, the Nigerian delegation is claiming that the Libyan delegation changed their flight plan just hours in advance and they didn't have time to receive them in Port Harcourt. If this was the case, if the Confederation of African Football had a body that, you know, had already established travel plans, then all of this would be clear from the get-go. But at the moment, a federation to federation, member association to member association, direct line of communication. And in this case, it's very much a case of he said, he said. And we don't really know the complete details until, you know, their communications are revealed.
How key are both these countries and teams to the AFCON tournament in general?
Well, Nigeria is an absolute giant of African football. They've won the African Cup of Nations 3 times. You know, it's the largest country in Africa in terms of population. Even like the brand, the key names of players that play in these tournaments, players like Victor Osimhen is the reigning African Player of the Year. So they are absolutely essential to the African Cup of Nations. And AFCON, without Nigeria, you can say is not really an AFCON. Libya have been struggling more so because of political problems in their country. For example, the football league, the domestic football league, has been going on and off, interrupted, really since 2013 until 2021. But in the last 2-3 years, especially in the eastern part of Libya, which is overseen by the military commander, Marshal Haftar, they have been hosting matches, especially in Benghazi. And those have been going well. One note that we should note, by the way, Sudan is actually hosting its matches in Libya this international window. And both the Sudanese and the Ghanaian national teams flew to Benghazi without any issue, and their planes were not diverted. So that seems to be one point that I think the Confederation of African Football will look at and blame the Libyans. So all of this to say, Libya has been affected by a lot of political turmoil in their country. And as a result, they haven't been to an African Cup of Nations from 2012, but they are very much desperate to sort of be back included into the continental conversation.
Is there anything then that CAF will do specifically? And I'm asking because now the Nigerian national team went back home, so the match is not going to happen as initially planned. What will they do?
Well, CAF, it should be mentioned, until the very end, until the Nigerian team stepped onto the airplane to return home, CAF was pushing for this match to be played. And that's important for a few different reasons. But it seems to indicate that despite all of these travails, CAF wanted this match to go ahead. And Libya, the football federation, the national team, is still posting as if there's going to be a match at 9 p.m. today. And what this kind of posturing indicates is that if this case were to go to the Court of Arbitration of Sport in Switzerland, the Libyans would say the Nigerians refused to play and the Nigerians should be docked points. That's one thing to note. But what I would say in general, for things like this, incidents like this, the number one option is usually to replay the match. The advantage that the Confederation of African Football has is that the African Cup of Nations is not going to take place until December of 2025. So essentially, we have 14 months before that tournament is being played, and you could probably find a window to play that match and to make it up in time. So that's probably going to be the first option. But if the Confederation of African Football, the Discipline Committee, decides that one team deserves to forfeit the match, you can rest assured that both football federations have already announced that they would probably head to the Court of Arbitration of Sport in Switzerland to ensure that their rights are respected.
How is all this going to play out at the end of the day, and what can be done to prevent such events from happening in the future?
Yeah, essentially, I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out legal battle unless the teams agree to replay the match. But I think what we spoke about earlier that could help, you know, avoid things like this happening in the future again, that we're essentially what we're going to need is a regulatory body within the Confederation of African Football that is in charge of logistics, in charge of ensuring that, you know, hosts respect their engagements and that visiting teams respect their travel plans. Some kind of travel body that would, you know, coordinate with both teams and ensure that there's a travel plan in place days ahead of time and that is not changed unless there's a case of force majeure. That's not going to stop hosts, you know, using their power to affect matches. You know, we still hear of cases, for example, of the visiting team's hotels being disturbed by fireworks or wedding celebrations, not allowing the visiting team to sleep. But these are things that happen in football. But what is completely not acceptable is for a team to be stranded in an airport for 15 hours without food, water, or even internet, or the most basic of services. If the Confederation of African Football can institute some kind of regulatory body to ensure that travel plans are respected, I think that will go a long way to fixing these issues.
Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Charles.
Mehe Mezahi in Algeria. And that's Focus on Africa today. The producers were Rob Wilson, Nyasha Michelle, and Victor Silva in London. Carney Sharp was a senior journalist overseeing the program, and Jonathan Greer was a technical producer. Our editors are Andre Lombard and Alice Mudengi. I'm Charles Gitonga. We'll speak again next time.
I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story Podcast, where we're asking how the U.S. election could impact the war in Ukraine. With Kamala Harris and Donald Trump neck and neck in the polls, President Zelensky's campaign to ensure crucial funds don't run out is increasingly uncertain. So will the result in November change his nation's fate? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.